And good morning. You are listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland. A minute before 9 o'clock, coming up in a half hour, join us as Fight the Empire host Per Fogering discusses oil and world disorder, drilling deep into hype and misinformation. At 10 o'clock today, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. Also, we'll have flashpoints between the covers and Black Book Talk this morning, all in a few hours here on The Boo. Coming up next, join us as Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch. Her commentary will focus on the courageous hunger strikers, the Frisco Five. She will also discuss the continuing climate emergency and give an imperialism update. That is all next on KBOO.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. A few topics here to give you the tools to destroy billionaire rule, I do hope. Edwin Lindo is one of five people who have undertaken a 15-day-old hunger strike. Yes, that's 15 days. Half a month in front of the San Francisco Mission District Police Station. The strikers want an end to police murders and have become an international celebrity called the Frisco Five. Here are Edwin Lindo's words recorded by Hoodline.com several days ago. He said, "All avenues have been exhausted." He said, "We have gone to rallies. We have gone to town hall meetings. We have gone to police commission meetings. The exact same things are happening every single day. The latest is our brother Luis Gongora, who is on 18th and Shotwell, a homeless man evicted from his home. Gentrification is a huge issue, and that's why we have criminalization. And the killing of the black and brown community. What's ironic," he said, "is that we are starving ourselves for justice in a city that has been starving our communities for decades. It continues to do it. It leaves black people on the streets living in tents. It leaves people on the streets living in tents," he said. "I supplied the black. It is pushing black communities out to less than 3% of this population. This is not chance. This has been calculated and planned. We are starving ourselves because the discomfort that we feel is nothing like what these victims felt. When I think of my hunger, I think of 56 bullets going through Alex Nieto. And that's what keeps me here," end quote. Further information on that from the broke-ass Stewart blog on the San Francisco Examiner site. Quote, "Setting up camp in front of the police station on Valencia Street, while also holding vigil for Nieto and others killed by San Francisco Police Department like Mario Woods, Amilcar Lopez, and Luis Gongora. The Frisco Five bring the reality of this tension home to roost. By being there directly in the middle of your stroll to brunch, they are asking this question, are you just going to walk by or are you going to stop, show your support, and do what you can to change things?" Now, speaking for myself, I'm bringing this up because although I've heard mention, far more than mention, excellent coverage of the Frisco Five on Davey D. Hard Knock Radio, the corporate media has absolutely ignored them. And I'm sorry to say, I was looking for this story on BreakingBrown.com and The Root and haven't found it. Perhaps they'll be running this story later. Information is not overflowing about this story. But the Frisco Five is happening, and I say the Frisco Five is history. History in the making right now. It's one of those things where you're going to be asked at some point in your life, what were you doing when the Frisco Five was happening? The writer I mentioned before says all manner of people right now can be found in the vicinity of the strikers there in the Mission District in front of the police station in San Francisco, offering moral support, bottles of water, etc. More recently, the hunger strikers have been attempting to meet publicly with Mayor Lee, scorning an earlier attempt by Lee to suddenly appear without media coverage. After 15 days without food, they've been reduced to wheelchairs, and they are pushed to meetings by their supporters. Tune in to Davey D's Hard Knock Radio at 7 p.m. on KBOO. We get it from KPFA, and you'll be able to get the latest in this historic anti-racist liberation saga. Now, changing topics, Joshua Frank writes in counterpunch.org, it's been a toxic few weeks at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation in eastern Washington. Not that this is exactly news. Hanford has been the most radioactive site in North America and is thereby always toxic. But what is news is how dangerous and negligent the remediation efforts at Hanford continue to be. He writes, the original Hanford Project, which manufactured plutonium for the world's first atomic bomb, and over its 40 years of operations produced 63 short tons of plutonium, is now home to the largest environmental cleanup in the country. The place is literally steaming with radioactivity. 56 million gallons of nuclear sludge currently sit in double-walled underground tanks built in the 1970s. And I want to stop there and speak for myself. Some of the tanks have double walls and some of them don't. But to return to the article, this waste is awaiting a plant to be built known as the Hanford Vit Plant that can turn the nasty gunk into glass rods. The Vit Plant, to be constructed by Bechtel, continues to run way over its initial budget estimates and keeps being delayed. The plant, if it's ever completed, will end up costing taxpayers over $30 billion. Meanwhile, the old holding tanks aren't fail-safe. They continue to be a colossal problem for the environment and workers alike. Once again, speaking for myself, the VIT is short for vitrification. The idea is you put this stuff, you kind of spread it out into glass logs, and it lasts for a long, long time. Years and years ago, I asked a proponent for the nuclear industry, did he really think that the glass logs would survive neutron embrittlement and production of gas, like production of radon gas from radioactive decay, and not crumble and split open before the initial 20,000-year mark. He said no. I pressed him on this. I actually made the man cry. I'm not really proud of that. But I was a kid, and I wanted a straight answer about nuclear waste, and I asked him, you know, why, if you know this, if you know that the day will come when these logs will split, even if they're actually made properly, these glass logs, vitrification logs, why are you involved in this? He says, I'm putting kids through college. Returning to the article, one of the tanks known as AY-102 began leaking in 2012. And now another, AY-101, is purportedly well on its way. The Department of Energy, the agency in charge of Hanford's nuke mess, says that AY-101 isn't leaking yet, but tells Gizmodo the tank is simply releasing higher than normal readings for contamination. And the reason I laughed is the only reason it would be having higher than normal readings would be if it's leaking. They really get dodgy about this sort of thing. I have heard that you cannot bring a Geiger counter into the vicinity, which makes me want to bring a Geiger counter into the vicinity. I certainly intend to do so. I want to go to Tri-Cities. I'm about to retire. Oh, my God, what a happy thing for me to say. I'm not going to have a regular 8-hour-a-day job, and I'm going to have time to do some actual reporting. All these years, I've been doing left opinion, and I've been regurgitating news that I find in other than mainstream sources, and I've enjoyed that, and I intend to continue doing it. But I've also liked doing a little bit, you know, just a little bit of actual go there, do that reporting. I always admired the old Mike Wallace style of bite me journalism. Well, I want to do that a little bit, you know, in the coming months. That's on the agenda as far as I'm concerned. Following on the radioactivity story. Now, as I said time and again, radioactivity is one of the dodgiest damn things that ever was. It's perfect for governments and big corporations who can always hide because it's invisible. You know, it's like if you've got a steel plant, there used to be one here in Portland that would belch its, and I do mean belch, its thick, thick black smoke at night. And the reason was because the very lame, stupid, caving into industry regulatory capture rule was that if you could not see through the smoke, there's certain opacity rules, then it was violating clean air rules. So The steel plants just do their stuff at night. If you ever wondered why they're working so hard at night over there years ago on the west side, well, it's because that way they can get around the rules and dump everything from cadmium and God knows what on you, which we're now finding out about. Anyway, Fukushima Diary reports the Japanese government is up to its usual obfuscation. On the 23rd of March this year, the Kashiwa City Government of Chiba announced 333 of 522 children were diagnosed with thyroid tumors in a recent test. In other words, they tested 522 kids in that town, and they found 333 of them had thyroid tumors. The local government states that testees are required to admit the test is not to evaluate the radiation effect on health after the 11th of March 2011 Fukushima disaster. Also, children who already have medical care for their thyroid problem were eliminated from the total number. Did you catch that? In other words, that 333 of 522, they didn't test the kids that they already know are sick. Sadly, what that really indicates is most of the kids in Chiba, Kashiwa City, are sick. Absolutely banned from the news. And especially in Japan, where the attitude is to suck it up and shut up about it. Don't create a contagion, you know. Don't get the people worked up with the truth. Okay, now turning to U.S. Imperial War. From antiwar.com, Jason Deitz, an excellent writer, writes, meetings among NATO defense ministers in Germany have ended with an agreement among the U.S. and other nations involved in the anti-ISIS coalition to do more in the war. According to the Defense Secretary Ash Carter, Carter did not provide much in the way of details on what more would entail, but it said involved confronting ISIS in both Iraq and Syria in an effort to keep the group from spreading beyond the region any further. Over the last 2 weeks, however, the U.S. has announced two significant escalations already of 200 troops each into Iraq and Syria. Britain also reported yesterday that they intend to send several hundred more troops to Iraq to join the 300 already there. That's on antiwar.com. Jason Deitz, he also writes on top of that, Secretary Carter announced just yesterday that the U.S. pardon me, is considering sending even more troops to Iraq and Syria above and beyond the ones already announced, saying the U.S. is always looking to build momentum in the war with more troops. The U.S. presently has over 5,000 ground troops in Iraq. Oh, did you know that? Why, we're not at war. We just have 5,000 ground troops there. 300 in Syria. Antiwar.com, Jason Deitz writes, in addition to Britain, several other nations have smaller deployments of trainers in Iraq, though no one else in the U.S. coalition is confirmed to have troops in Syria. Though President Obama has repeatedly ruled out boots on the ground by sending small numbers in each escalation over the course of a year and a half, the U.S. has built a significant military presence in the region. Other nations have so far been extremely reluctant to commit ground troops, and Iraq officials have resisted the idea of too many foreign troops in the country, particularly from the Sunni Arab nations in the U.S. coalition. Speaking for myself, it's a Shia government. It's a Sunni stand that the U.S. is trying to create by funding by way of Saudi and Turkey. And as I mentioned last week, that whole scam, the U.S. is making ISIS happen. Continuing on that line, on the imperialism update, by the way, it's 13 minutes after 9, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. This is Press Watch. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Wall Street Journal says Russia is creating three new divisions to counter the North Atlantic Treaty Organization's planned expansion along its eastern flank. Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu said Wednesday, in a move that comes amid rising tensions in the region, Moscow has threatened it will respond to NATO plans to boost its troops' presence along its border with Russia. Western officials said last week the alliance will send four battalions, about 4,000 troops, to Poland and the ex-Soviet Baltic countries. Now, speaking for myself, what you will see in the Wall Street Journal and all the Western media just about is all of these, all the framing, like, oh, those Russians are just out of hand and we're just reacting to them and this kind of admits that they're reacting to us. Of course, the Russians don't have the money to maintain the amount of troops the U.S. does. By taking half of your tax money, oh, yes, they do. We can have troops around the world confronting everybody. And everybody just loves us for it. There's nothing like having a gun in your face. Put a smile on your face. Make you love that gun holder. Oh, yeah. As long as they're looking anyway. But returning to the article, the Defense Ministry is taking a series of measures to counter the expansion of NATO forces in direct proximity to the Russian border, said Mr. Shoigu. The announcement, Wall Street Journal writes, of troop increases at the border follow incidents that have raised concern about a potential crisis in the Baltics. Russian warplanes intercepted a U.S. Navy destroyer and an Air Force plane last month. And, of course, what they don't say is the U.S. Navy destroyer was in the Baltic Sea and very close to Russia and threatening them by flashing radar at them. Oh, but they seem to have left that out. Funny. But going back to the Wall Street Journal, according to U.S. account, Russian warplanes and a military helicopter repeatedly buzzed the USS Donald Cook, flying to within 75 feet of the warship as it carried out operations on the Baltic Sea. Now, I'm sorry, I do have to comment some more, but I'll just keep it to nuclear war. Returning to the article, Alexander Gultz, a Russian military analyst and visiting researcher at Uppsala University in Sweden, said such incidents would continue until Russian President Vladimir Putin believed Washington was treating Moscow on an equal basis. And there's more on that article if you have the stomach for it at Wall Street Journal. Now I'll turn to the other side's propaganda at RT.com. They ask Patrick Henningsen, who is an expert of some sort, I guess, how much of an effect could the ceasefire agreed by Moscow and Washington have on the situation in Aleppo, Syria? And Patrick Henningsen replied, I don't really think it's going to change the situation on the ground. I think what you have is a situation where extremist groups, call it moderate rebels or call it terrorist groups, they're going to use the ceasefire to buy time to get reinforcements lined up to establish new supply lines that have been damaged by Russian airstrikes over the last couple of months. The problem is that the Al-Nusra Front or Ahrar al-Sham are all these terrorist groups that are operating freely in these rebel-held areas. They are ubiquitous with the so-called opposition. You can't separate them. This is just a game. This is being played. The U.S. knows this quite well. Meanwhile, the diplomats have to play the diplomatic due process, so they're doing their job. But behind the scenes here, there's a whole other agenda playing out. Now, speaking for myself, this is what I've been saying, is that when you hear that arms have gone to the al-Nusra Front and, gee, they just can't seem to find them anymore, it's because they went to ISIS. But returning to the article, then RT asks, U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter recently accused Russia of fueling the civil war by supporting Assad. Could such statements make it more difficult for Russia and the U.S. to work together on the peace effort? And he responds, firstly, the U.S. Defense Secretary is using language that doesn't actually apply to this conflict. He's doing this to try to reframe the narrative. He is calling it a civil war. This is not a civil war by any stretch of the imagination. It ceased being a civil war back in 2011, maybe early in 2012, but after that it is anything but a civil war. This is a conflict. It is a proxy war. Once again, speaking for myself, this is a repeat of the situation in Vietnam, in which the U.S. tried to call it a conflict, not a war, and tried to call it a civil war, even though every person that was being held up in the South was a U.S. puppet. Returning to the RT article, their interviewee says, firstly, the U.S. Defense Secretary is using language that... Oh, I'm sorry, I already repeated that. What you have, he said, is the U.S. will do what is called a strategy of confusion in terms of public relations. That's against you, by the way. So John Kerry is the good cop. He is there with Sergei Lavrov, trying to hammer out a peace deal in Geneva, and Ash Carter is playing the bad cop. He's making inflammatory statements. They're trying to characterize Russia as a bad guy. And then President Obama might have another statement on what he does. And the State Department spokesman will say something else. This is what the U.S. does constantly. This is their strategy of PR confusion so that no one knows exactly where they stand on any of the issues. Once again, departing from the article and speaking for myself, I think that's why it's perfect that the State Department spokesperson, the White House spokesperson, is Josh Earnest. Now, he could have left his full first name, Joshua, and come to the stage as Joshua Earnest, who would sound just heavy as lead. You would imagine him with a stovepipe hat and a big beard, Joshua Earnest. Well, no, he's Josh Earnest. So you don't know if he's joshing you or if he's being earnest. It's perfect, absolutely perfect. Josh Earnest reminds me when Bush was conducting his wars and his spokesperson was Ari Fleischer. /. But anyway, RT writes, this is what the U.S. does constantly. This is their strategy of PR confusion so that no one knows exactly where they stand on any of the issues. This used to basically obscure and cover up what is essentially a dirty war going on the ground in Syria right now. And RT asks, Russia, meanwhile, has said it is not supporting the Assad government. Why would the U.S. object to what Russia is doing? And he says, I think it's out of frustration. Russia came in with a very clear objective back in October 2015, and they achieved that objective by a lot of people's estimation. Then they receded their operation. They packed up and left a large portion of the military footprint there. This upset everybody because the U.S. was saying that Russia was being dragged into a quagmire. At every turn, the narratives that are being conjured up by the State Department are getting knocked down and disintegrating. This is just, I believe, frustration. This is a PR war. We're looking at a public relations war. The U.S. and George Soros have spent millions of dollars over the last couple of weeks launching the Aleppo is burning meme. It's a PR campaign designed to get people behind a no-bombing zone. So the no-fly zone became the safe zone. Now it's a no-bombing zone. This is a public relations war with a level of sophistication we've never seen before. You can find more on that article at rt.com. 19 minutes after the hour, Press Watch on KBOO Portland coming up. Per Fagering at 9:30 and at 10 o'clock, Chris Andre. I'd like to congratulate Chris, by the way, on that interview with Bernie Sanders. Quite a thing there. The Bernie Sanders effort is being pretty thoroughly drowned in the U.S. press. If you look up, and it's hard to do, I encourage you to try. Use a search engine and try to find how many delegates Bernie Sanders now has compared, I'm talking about pledged delegates, delegates won in primaries, compared to how many delegates Clinton has. You'll find that it's a very interesting number, especially given how many delegates are yet to be won. And, of course, the Oregon vote's coming up. And I just think it's fascinating how little we hear about that mild socialism that Bernie Sanders is talking about. And, of course, now there's talk about how, like Pat Robertson, Bernie Sanders will have a gigantic voter database after this, which can be engaged indefinitely. And, Democrat Party is going to have to react to that. So what an interesting election with Trump now taking the Republican nomination. And Sanders still quite powerful, so powerful that the press is just afraid to talk about him at all, except to say, it's over, it's over, it's over, it's over, it's over, and never give you the numbers. So, to climate change. Before I get to this, last week I was talking about the climate change emergency, and speaking of the tongues of hot air that were swirling around the pole, this next article from Scientific American directly relates to that. This is following on last week's prediction that there would be disasters. An unusually intense May wildfire roared into Fort McMurray, Alberta, Canada on Tuesday, forcing the largest wildfire evacuation in province history. The flames rode the back of hot, windy weather that will continue through Wednesday and could pick up again this weekend. The wildfire is the latest in a lengthening lineage of early wildfires in the northern reaches of the globe that are indicative of a changing climate. And Scientific American writes, as the planet continues to warm, these types of fires will likely become only more common and intense as spring snowpack disappears and temperatures warm. Mike Flanagan, wildfire researcher, at the University of Alberta, said this fire is consistent with what we expect from human-caused climate change affecting our fire regime. At least one neighborhood of the northern Albertan city of 61,000 people has been nearly entirely razed as the blaze ripped through their city from the west on Tuesday. Temperatures soared into low 90s, up to 40 degrees Fahrenheit above normal for this time of year. 40 degrees Fahrenheit above normal for this time of year, or if you're Canadian, 22 degrees centigrade, coupled with high winds that helped fan the flames late that afternoon. Talking about those tongues of air sliding down from the pole, this is one of them. That sent 80,000 people into the city, they write, and surrounding areas scrambling north and south through a post-apocalyptic landscape of trees lit up like matchsticks and flashing emergency lights. And if I can get it, I think I have some of the fire chief speaking about this situation from Canadian Broadcast Company, used without permission.
I would say it's been the it's been the worst day of my career. And I am... you know, the whole, the people here are devastated. Everyone's devastated. The community is going to be devastated. This is going to go on. This is going to take us a while to come back from.
Video shows raging flames.
We've had a devastating day. Fort McMurray has been overrun by wildfire. With the temperatures and the low humidity and then the wind got up, all of a sudden areas of the city were becoming...
And you can tell he's just kind of choking. He's just absolutely overwhelmed by this situation, and he's the fire chief. That is the voice of global warming. That is what is coming this year, right now. This is your planet. This is an emergency. The point that I would like to make. And returning to the article, couldn't see 2 feet in front of your truck through all that smoke. They all drive trucks there. That's a quote of a Fort McMurray resident from an evacuation center. Everyone had to be run out of town. Everyone had to leave. There was a photograph of somebody's kitty cats that someone else rescued because the flames were coming so hot and so fast, people just had to run. They charged down the road. They tried to get gas. Gas station ran out of gas. You can see cars and trucks, mostly trucks, parked at gas stations. And gas station was empty. Gas station blew up. Absolute terror. And the other story is how much people are helping each other, but there's more of that in this article. 80% of the homes in one neighborhood have been destroyed, though the full extent of the damage isn't fully known yet. It may very well not be over, as hot, dry conditions were expected again. What's happening in Fort McMurray is a perfect encapsulation of the wicked ways that climate change is impacting wildfire season. A drier than normal winter left a paltry spring snowpack, which was quickly eaten away by warm temperatures that left plenty of fuel on the ground for wildfires to consume. Add in this week's temperatures, which soared far above normal, and you have a clear view of how much climate change is affecting wildfire season, not just in Alberta, Canada, but across the northern reaches of the globe. Scientific American writes, boreal forests are burning at a rate unprecedented in the last 10,000 years, a climate central analysis of Alaskan wildfires last year showed that the season is 40% longer than it was 65 years ago. Large wildfires there have also doubled over that time. In Canada, wildfire season now starts a month earlier than it used to, and the average annual area burned has doubled since 1970, according to Flanagan. Speaking for myself, we were hearing similar statistics about what happens here in Oregon and Washington. We hear about climate change. We hear about what might happen by the end of the century. But the point I want to make is once the forest burns, it has burned. Once the West Hills burns, it has burned. The West Hills has burned before. I think a lot of people don't know that. In the history of Portland, it has happened before. I think it was in the 20s or 30s of the last century. Just burned up. Climate change has been altering background conditions, they write, but this year's El Nino also likely played a role in this particularly severe start to wildfire season in Western Canada. Following the 1997 to 98 Super El Nino, Western Canada experienced a particularly severe wildfire season. In this part of the world, Flanagan said, El Nino means warm and dry. We've had a warm and dry winter and now a warm and dry spring. If I was putting odds on it, odds are we will have another bad fire season, end quote. When these fires reach cities and towns, the results are devastating. In Fort McMurray, which was the hub of Canadian tar sands boom that has since quieted with the collapse of oil prices, the economic costs could reach hundreds of millions of dollars if past fires are any indicator. But Scientific American, publishing an article from Climate Central, writes, wildfires like this can also wreak havoc on global climate. Boreal forests contain nearly 30% of the world's carbon stored on land. As they light up, they send that carbon into the atmosphere where it warms the globe. Intense wildfires are already turning some forests into carbon polluters in certain years, creating a feedback cycle that drives temperatures higher and raises fire risks even further. And what they don't say is that the soot lands on the glaciers in the north, particularly in Greenland, causing that snow to melt, worsening things, creating a cold pool south of Greenland that is driving extreme storms. So here it comes. You've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. We've been going out to you via the transmitter on 90.7 FM and other frequencies elsewhere in Cascadia. Stay tuned for Parafogging and more of the radio zine. We're also going out to you via KBOO.FM, and a lot of you donated on KBOO.FM and on our pledge drive, which ended up this week. And I'm very grateful to those of you who called in or who clicked in and pledged. That's how we do it, and that's how we're going to continue to fight the power via our transmitter teamed with the World Wide Web. And in that way, we go to the world and all the ships at sea.
Guys,
thank you so much for your support.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for all your support during our recently completed spring membership drive. We can't do it without you. Thanks to all of our renewing members, our new members, and everyone who helped get KBOO to this fantastic place it is today. We really appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, good morning. This is Fight the Empire. My name is Per Fograng, and we're going to talk about oil, which is what keeps us fed and clothed and housed and in any state of well-being. Pretty hard to get along without oil. In 2013, the world's top oil producer was